2007. I want to welcome everyone. I'm sorry that we don't have more committee members. They will come in. They're just running late. And it's that time in the session, unfortunately. So today we're going to have an informational meeting. I need to just say that we lose our House members at 4 o'clock, and the Senate goes back on the floor at 4:30, so I'm going to open without all the committee members here for that reason. And I'm going to welcome Deb Truesdell to the podium. And do you both want to come at the same time, or are you coming first with yours?
Just coming with mine.
All right, good. Very, very good. Sure. Welcome, yes.
Will you indulge me as I welcome my constituent?
Thank you.
Thank you for coming, Deb.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the invitation.
Yes, it?
Yes, please.
And if you'll just introduce yourself, tell us who you are and where you're from before you start.
Absolutely, I'd be pleased to. Well, my name is Deb Truesdell, and I've lived in the Pacific Northwest for about 25 years. Originally grew up in the Washington, D.C. metro area, so I'm used to coming to capitals.
How bad?
I've been in Seaside. I've lived in Seaside for about 2.5 years, and I was recently awarded an opportunity to consult with the City of Seaside to carry out a 12-month grant that they received on emergency preparedness. And I heard through the grapevine that you like really simple, small handouts. So I kept it to 2 pages.
All right.
This is just a brief outline of what we're doing in Seaside. As I've been talking with Mr. Keller, he said that I might have 5 minutes, I might have 20. He didn't know how much time we were going to have because of your schedules. So I'm going to try and make this presentation in about 10 minutes and then open it up for questions if you have any questions. So, I saw Senator Verger last week at the Oregon Emergency Management Association meeting. And we missed you, Representative Boone, but I understand you just weren't able to make it.
Time-wise, I had to be on the floor at 10 o'clock.
So I understand. But
I don't have the plane.
But the Senator and Representative Boquist did a fine job of relaying the legislature's commitment to emergency preparedness, so we appreciated that. But one of the things that I was very pleased to hear is that both the Senator and the Representative mentioned that Seaside has a reputation for doing some good things around emergency preparedness. And that's to my good fortune, because I'm not starting at ground one on a 12-month contract with a long ways to go. We've already made some headway. Many of you will remember that probably about 3 years ago, the City of Seaside received a grant, and a woman named Darcy Connor did emergency preparedness workshops and did a lot of groundbreaking work as far as finding out what works and what doesn't work. As a follow-up to that, I've now been contracted to pick up the ball and run with it. You may or may not be aware that through Senator Wu, he was able to get us a grant in excess of $425,000 for the City of Seaside, and most of that's outlined here. The bulk of that money is going to go for a new siren system down on the beach, in the beach area. 2 sirens will actually be going into Gearhart, and the rest will be going in the Seaside area. In addition to that, there will be funds available for a reverse 911 system so that we'll be able to actually call homes when an emergency happens. The other things in that particular grant that are put together there are actually more community-based projects, and those are the things that I'm involved with. So I've been on the job for about 3 months, and so far I've really been doing some groundwork within the city to make sure that we have a really good foundation to start. One of the things I didn't want to do is just do a bunch of workshops and say we've done this, we've trained some people, because that's not going to be sustainable, and we really want to make sure that this is sustainable and continues to go on. People move in, people move out, we have visitors. We have to have information and preparedness that really will make a difference and will be sustained. So I came up with PREP. So tsunami PREP is the umbrella term for this, and PREP stands for People Ready with Emergency Plans, and that's basically the program that I'm running. The community outreach piece is the thing that I'm really going to be the most involved with, and I've given you some bullet items here as to what we're doing to create that sustainable volunteer network. And that's where the previous efforts have fallen short, if you can call it that, that they were designed at the time to find out what works. Now we know the types of things that work, so now we want to implement those. So we're going to have tsunami prep squads, and tsunami prep squads are going to be delegated by people's interest level and the types of things that they want to do. We have a tremendous tremendous volunteer base in Seaside. There's probably between 20 and 30 people that have already approached me that said, yes, I want to volunteer, I want to be involved. And when Darcy did her program 3 years ago, she had a groundswell of support, and a lot of people put in a lot of hours. So we're very optimistic about that. In addition to the part of the squads, we'll have a neighbor-to-neighbor component. This was something that was pioneered at the last time, and we will actually have squads that will pick a geographic location, they'll go out into the neighborhoods, and they'll actually go door-to-door talking to people, letting people know. We can run ads in the newspaper, we can do television and radio, we can do a lot of that type of information, but you really have to talk one-on-one with people. You really have to make sure that they understand the information that they're given. We'll also be doing school presentations, business workshops, communications as well. Ham radio operators, I don't know what your exposure has been in the past with ham radio operators. They are an energetic group of people. They are dedicated.
Singing your song.
They are dedicated volunteers, and I'm really looking for. Have you had experience with them, sir?
Senator Morissette is very enthusiastic about us hearing from them.
Well, only because we had a bill that would have prevented people from talking on cell phones in cars, and so suddenly I started hearing from people, you know, from ham radio operators saying this is ridiculous because apparently they have devices in their vehicles that they talk over, not just in their home with the big. So is this true? What value are ham operators? We haven't talked about ham radio operators.
No, we have not.
I would encourage this committee to listen to them, and I can certainly put you in touch with the people in our area. They are actually they're licensed by the FCC, mm-hmm. So they have gone through a certain level of security and criminal background checks. A large majority of them are retired military personnel. So what you have is a highly skilled, highly trained, highly motivated group of volunteers. And actually part of getting, I'm in the process of getting my ham license mm-hmm. now. And part of the process is that you learn about the operation, but in order to get licensed, you have to say that in a case of an emergency, you will utilize your equipment and your expertise to aid and assist in that. And they are actually part of the EAS, the Emergency Activation System. They are actually linked into that. So in our counties, they're actually become an official part of the emergency network when this comes in. During Katrina, and this is a very, I've been in this 3 months, so I've packed a lot of information into that period of time, but the ham radio operators really will provide an integral part of this whole process. During Katrina, at various times throughout that entire crisis, the only communication that was happening was through mm-hmm. ham radio operators.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we have systems and we may have redundancy in systems, police, the fire department, but as we know, communications become incredibly important. And as a matter of fact, that's a big part of what I've been doing the past 3 months, is really honing in on the intricate micro details of the communication process. Because we can have these big multi-million-dollar systems and whatever, but as soon as the plug is pulled, then what happens?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we're working on some of these things. But the ham radio operators really can be a huge resource to us in that regard. Mm-hmm. And part of it is just because there's so many of them. There's over 250 ham radio operators in Clatsop County, registered ham radio operators. And so the gory results of that is we may have a system in place, two or three. We may have backup systems to our backup systems, but even those will go. With 250 ham radio operators with equipment, even in the worst disaster possible, some of them will survive. And so that's kind of worst-case scenario looking at it. Their sheer numbers make them. But anyway, I didn't come here to talk about ham radio, but I'm glad you're.
But we're glad you're talking about it.
But we
want to know about them.
I would really encourage you to ask them to come and speak, and believe me, they will be more than happy to do so. And you'll be lucky if they give you 2 pages. They probably will bring a book with you, but really very definitely. And if you talk to people involved in emergency preparedness, sheriff's departments, things like that, they're pretty aware.
They never mention that.
Really. Well, you know, it might be kind of a turf thing. I don't know. I mean, it might be. And the other thing is they are volunteers. And so, you know, being able to effectively manage and supervise volunteers is a really key component of everything that we're doing. And that's part of the reason that they went with me, because my expertise is really in marketing, public relations, and working with volunteers and building coalitions. There's tons of experts on tsunamis and even emergency preparedness. We have all the information that we could ever need. There's websites, everything. What we don't have is an effective, or what we're working towards, but we don't have yet, is that really effective thing where we've changed systemically the community. So 5 years from now, the whole community is just that much more prepared and aware and motivated to do something about it. And so that's really what I'm working on. So we're hoping to engage the ham radio operators as part of this. We'll have them have a big part in the tsunami prep squads. CERTs, our community emergency response teams. That's something that we'll probably do the next year. I don't think we'll have time to do it during this year, but that's going to be something. Are you aware of what CERT is? Okay, exactly. Evacuation caches, that's another thing that falls under this grant. We're going to work with citizens who live on high ground to develop their resources there. Seaside's a pretty amazing place. I've had people approach me and they say, hey, you know, I live up here in Sunset Hills, and we've been talking to some neighbors, and we'd be willing to put some supplies in our garages. And that's the kind of detail that we're talking about doing at this point. Much of what I'm going to be involved with personally is really on the micro level, not the macro level. An awful lot of those plans and things are in place, but how does it really get to Mrs. Jones, who lives alone down the street? Those are the types of things that we're really working on. NOAA weather radios, one of my favorite topics right now. Our city council just approved our bid process last night for the NOAA weather radios. Part of this grant was providing funds so that every household in Seaside can have a NOAA weather radio, which will be activated when and if there is a major weather occurrence or some kind of major emergency. That sounds pretty simple, doesn't it? It's not a simple process. And the reason I say that is there's many, many weather radios out there to choose from. Not only that, because of the many disasters that our country is incurring right now, it's difficult to buy them in bulk. There's one model that we chose, the WR100 made by Midland, and we thought it was in the right price range. It was one of the easier ones to operate. We thought it would be fairly plug and play. Over 100 of those, that model, were sold in the month of February alone because of all of the disasters and things. Because people in FEMA and other emergency preparedness organizations are really encouraging people to have them, which is great, but they're a little difficult to get a hold of now. So we will be able to get them, but you can't get them all at once. But distributing them brings another issue, which, again, I'm looking at very, very closely. Now, if we wanted to just stack up the radios and hand them out, that'd be great. And we could check that off, and we could come and tell you, hey, every household in Seaside has one of these. However, Mrs. Jones might not know how to program that. And when it goes off, what is Mr. Flattery going to do? One of the things that I want to be very cautious of is that by putting a device like that in the home, that we not cause more panic by having that come off. So what we're really trying to do, and I've listed the three things we're going to do, we would like to distribute these radios as part of a training process, not just hand them over the counter and say, here's your NOAA radio, now you'll know what to do. But we want to actually have time to get in front of everyone as we do this. Now, we have enough money for a little over 3,700 radios. It's not realistic to think that those are going to go out the door in 30 days. I don't think people are going to be lining up to do this. I think there'll be a rush, and some people will want them, and then it'll go away. But that's great because we'll have time to do the training, and there's also going to be turnover. People are going to move in and out, so we want to be able to do that. And the reason I bring this up and talk about this in such detail is this is a real good example of my approach in this project and how I think we need to work it. We've really thought this through, and looking at if we don't have the proper education to go along with a tool like this, and that goes for our 72-hour PACs, the emergency information, misinformation is more dangerous than no information at all. And in the past winter storm, we had differences of opinion when the Portland television stations send out differing messages about a tsunami, which happened at the last tsunami 2 years ago. citizens are confused, and some of them think that it's that they're in danger, and some of them realize that there's nothing to happen. So that's one of the reasons that we're looking at this so clearly. We're really hoping to just not pass them out on the shelf, but really everything we do, we want to provide a certain amount of training and information. If people are unwilling or unable to come, then we will take the neighbor-to-neighbor approach, and hopefully during our little neighborhood walks, they can share the same information and perhaps even deliver the NOAA radio.
Madam Chair, I have a quick question while you're on the subject.
Sure.
If you, when you hand them out, if you, are you going to log it in as this address has
yes.
one, so that when people move, hopefully they'll voluntarily just return them to you, so you can use them just if they move to Portland or
that,
something.
That would be the hope.
Yeah.
That would be the hope.
Yeah.
Again, they have to pay 50% of the cost. So to say, you know, they probably would have the right to take it. But at that, my hope would be in 3 years. Because, again, I'm thinking long-term on this because that's how we have to think. In 3 to 5 years, everyone will just pay the $30 or $40 to get their own radio, and it's not going to be an issue. I think to introduce it into the community, we're giving them a cost break, which always brings people in. But I think when they realize how important it is and how useful a tool it will be, hopefully they'll be motivated themselves to do the purchase price. But, yeah, we have a master list of all of the – and, of course, in our area, there are many vacation rentals, and so we will be making an extra effort to communicate with people who perhaps don't live there but own the homes to make sure that they have one in the vacation rentals. And in that case and one of the things that we're looking at is that thing goes off, and it gives a lot of information. Sometimes it gives the latitude and the longitude and what happened. And some people can be confused by the amount of information that comes across. So we're working very closely with our local radio stations to make sure that, and we're thinking of maybe even putting a label right on the NOAA radio that says, if this goes off with an emergency message, tune to these AM and FM stations, because that information will be a little more filtered, and it will basically say, you know, Seaside, Cannon Beach, Gearhart, this is what you're looking at. So we're really trying to look at the details so that Mrs. Jones and Mr. Flattery and everyone knows exactly what to do. Because in looking at events that have happened in the past, that's where the breakdown has come, is when the information comes out, what does that really mean to our community? And we want to make that as streamlined as possible to get to them. And then in the event that they don't want to participate in any of that, of course, we'll make the radios available to people. But we actually want to go through the programming process. There's about 4 different ways to program them. And if they're not programmed properly, then they're not going to work. And then in that case, you're worse off because you think you have something that's going to alert you, and maybe it won't go off. So... And so anyway, in closing, I'll just tell you the sustainable partnerships are really going to be, I think, the key to our success. And that's what I've been working on the last few months. Some entity, some organization has to carry on the ball when I'm carry the ball on when I'm not around. And, you know, it would be best if we had a volunteer coordinator. It would be best if we could continue on, but if funding's not available, at least we have a good shot at this. Kevin Couples is the head of city planning, and he's the one who has written all these grants and has really kept the ball going as far as the tsunami preparedness in Seaside. Chief Bob Gross, some of you may know him. He's been with the city for a couple of years. He's been very enthusiastic. He's just started a Citizens Academy, which is going to be a feeder for volunteers for the police department, and we've talked about doing a lot of cross pollination and collaboration between the two groups. We have a brand new fire chief, Dale Camrath, and we're really lucky to have him, and he has agreed to provide the ongoing umbrella supervision for the tsunami prep and the certs and things like that. He's a NIMS instructor. He's very pro emergency prep, and it was fortunate that he came along, because I think he's more that way than the average fire chief would be. So that's all. And we, right down to the level of the director of the library, is going to be working on the newsletter as well as helping to revamp the website. And the reason that I've spent time recruiting these individuals and courting them and getting them on board is they'll be there after this project is gone. They'll have a vested interest. We'll have it set up in a system so that it will continue on. We're also doing, this is not everybody's favorite piece, but we're also doing a preparedness audit in all of the departments of the city. So I've gone and interviewed, I'm about halfway through that process, because we felt if we were going to go to businesses in Seaside and say, you need to be prepared, you need to do some things to be prepared, that all the city departments should be complying and doing the same things. So every department in the city of Seaside government will have a no-weather radio there, and they'll have some basic training on emergency preparedness. If you go into any room of 10 or 15 people and you have a wide variety of what their level of understanding is and what their motivation to be prepared is, and that's the biggest thing.
Ms. Tristel, what do you refer to when you're talking about the NOAA weather radios and the programming?
Well, there's just three different options. You can have it make a tone. You can have it actually have a voice message that says this is an emergency thing, or you can actually have it read out on the screen and some buttons light up. So there's some options in the way that you actually set up the various radios.
But they don't work unless there is an emergency and unless there is a program going on. Isn't that true?
That is correct. Now, they have a button just for weather. You can just push the button and it will give you the weather. But they do not go off. But they're tested every Wednesday. Every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, a test goes out. And that's what we're doing because we've discovered that they don't all work. And they don't all work in every building. Seaside is just about in the middle of the signal area, and the signal strength for NOAA radio. Again, like I said, it's just not as simple as here's your NOAA radio. My office is directly across from the police station in Seaside, and I have to get an external antenna for mine because the signal's just kind of iffy.
I have one that doesn't work.
Well, see,
and I don't know why it doesn't work because it's brand new. Mm-hmm. That's the reason I was going to ask you about the program.
I can help you find some information on that. There's ways to program them. A lot of it's just a signal issue. And again, the ham radio operators, I got to tell you, these guys went out and did a lot of research for me. They took, they get very enthusiastic about these things, and they took different radios out into different areas in their cars to see where they would work. And this is just not something that's going to be safe to just hand over to someone and say, here, use this. Mm-hmm. We really have to do our homework and make sure that when they take that it's really going to do the job. Mm-hmm. So I'm not glad to hear that yours doesn't work. But
I didn't know it didn't work until we had a power outage and I tried to get it to work, and then I couldn't get it to work.
Oh, did you plug it in with the power outage?
Yeah, no. I unplugged.
Could I have a...
No,
you have a question.
Oh, okay. Well, Seaside has two rivers running right down the middle of it, and how in the world are people, 12,000 people on the beach when a tsunami hits, going to cross those rivers without drowning?
I'm glad you asked that question. The basic part of our information and the basic part of our message is going to be there are two kinds of events. And that's got to be our first message and the most important message. There's a near event, which is basically we're talking about the Cascadia subduction zone, and then we're talking about distant events. If it's a distant event, if it's a distant tsunami, we'll have an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours to evacuate. If it's the subduction zone, there is not a good answer to your question. Basically, I've talked to some of the best minds in science. And some of the bridges may or may not exist. They may not survive the initial earthquake. And it's going to be extremely grim when that happens. I guess they're saying it's not an if, but when it happens. Some of the bridges are newer than others. But where I'm located, we have the evacuation maps. And I'm located so that I don't have, my office is located so that I don't have to traverse a river to get to high ground. But the people that are behind that, we do have a couple of buildings that we think were built recently enough that might withstand that magnitude of an earthquake. But because we don't have anything, because it happened in 1700 the last time, we really don't know exactly how that's going to be.
Well, it just seems with all of the planning, the pre-planning that's gone on Seaside, from the last grant that you had with a woman spent a year going, nobody ever said anything about how to get across those rivers if it's an immediate event. And you look at the aerial map, and there are just those two long rivers that go right down the middle of Seaside with every once in a while there's, I don't know how many bridges there are.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a rush of people trying to get across, they're going to go into the
Absolutely.
River. Is the river too deep to
Well, there is. Well, and it's not just the river, because there's a lot of other factors. Liquefaction will take place in many of the areas, and so a lot of the area there'll be down. You know, power lines will be down. But the whole concept of bridges has been discussed a lot.
Okay.
It's going to be in the millions of dollars to replace them. And there are some people there are some schools of thought, because we have a local geologist, Tom Horning, who lives in Seaside, who has some strong opinions on this. And right now, what they're looking at and trying to determine is, do we want to build those bridges, or do we want to build footbridges as an alternative? Because you won't be able to use vehicles in the event of a major tsunami anyway. I mean, when the big one hits, vehicles are out of the question. It's going to be everyone on foot trying to get to high ground as quickly as possible. And so one of the things that the city planning department is looking at is, do we devise some footpaths that hopefully will be built to be sustained so that people can get across those.
Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've done a lot of work, but I would suspect that this has happened, the process you're going through has happened, for instance, in Japan a long time ago. Have you compared how they are preparing for these type of events, and you look at schools and businesses and this type of thing? Have you looked for any model that they've already developed to address these things?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, a lot of the model that we'll be using is what was used 3 years ago. I mean, the curriculums exist, the information, the models are available. We've been in touch with Hawaii prior to me coming on board. We've talked with Hawaii, haven't talked with Japan, but the models and the information are there and readily available. So we have curriculum for everything.
Follow up.
I think it might do well to contact the Japanese, because they've got a culture that this is an awareness in their culture, in schools, in business, in the military, and everything. And somehow they've developed it, and then they've carried it forward through the generations. And they've done a lot in preparation, you know, even the seawalls that they've put up, different than what's been anywhere else. So I would suggest that you do make some effort to see what type of model they use to continue the education and preparedness.
Excellent. Very good.
Mr. Trista, you know, it's easy for you to just say quickly, like partnerships with city agencies and departments. That takes a tremendous amount of one-on-one and time. Do you just schedule calendar-wise? I wish we had. I love the two-page. But I want to know more, because basically what you're doing in Seaside, we need to just duplicate in every township and small town and city in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to get people's attention about what's going to happen. Number one, it's not going to happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing, people. And that's a happy thought, that it won't happen to me. The other thing is, if it does happen, somebody's going to take care of me.
Mm-hmm.
And so to dispel both of those myths, this is exactly what we need to do. And comment on your established organizations and continue your presentation, and then go back and be a little bit more detailed for me about really exactly how you do this. You've come on now as a hired employee, right?
Well, as an independent consultant.
Independent consultant there in the city. So I think that we need to find out a little bit more about how this occurs, because we can't clone you and put you in every place, and every place doesn't have the funds. Some places do, however.
Mm-hmm.
And so continue on and finish.
Well, as far as the established organizations, that is just kind of a laundry list of some of the people that I've been collaborating with. Again, I just attended the Oregon Emergency Management Association conference last week and met a lot of interesting people, one of which several people who are licensed psychologists or social workers who are specializing and promised to give me materials on how to really scare the jeepers out of everyone, which is what many of the emergency preparedness people feel we need to do to get their attention. And so I will be, you know, within a couple of months' time, I'll be able to give you a comprehensive 20-page report and outline on exactly how to do this, if that's something that you would like to have, and, you know, detailing, you know, every step of the way and kind of the program, because I understand the need for that. But it has taken a lot of time, and basically I've just been meeting with every organization that I can, talking to people, and it's taken the one-on-one with the fire chief. It's taken the one-on-one discussions, you know, with the police chief. It's just taken getting them on board, and it's going to be easier in some communities than others. As far as details,
and I don't want you to think that I'm picking your brain here. This is your profession, and you do this. Even a report, however, requires a person.
Yes.
So that's all you're doing is just telling us a little bit about how it's done. It isn't going to replace the person, mm-hmm. such as yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just curious, and I thought a lot about this. You know, Neighborhood Watch mm-hmm. has worked. Are you trying to take it neighborhood by neighborhood? Mm-hmm. Are you taking just different volunteers and having them go out and try to work it neighborhood by neighborhood?
It will be, the fire department will be the umbrella.
Okay.
And think of it in terms of a CERT. A CERT reports directly to the fire department, and they're kind of under that. However, CERT isn't really going to accomplish what we need, because a CERT is trained to help rescue people from buildings, do traffic control, things of that
right.
nature. So we want to take it down a level to people that just want to go in their neighborhoods and educate folks. And again, in Seaside, we have some highly motivated people. I think that the biggest key is to get people that are interested in this and have a passion. And so really the first thing is volunteer recruiting, and this is where I rely on kind of my marketing and public relations. You have to make it interesting to people. You have to give them something back. And that's the, that's really the, I think the attraction of the CERT team is people want to feel like they're a firefighter. They want to be engaged. They want to know about. So the same thing goes with this. If people are interested, and oddly enough, tsunamis are sexy. Tsunamis, people find them very interesting. People will come to symposiums. People will come to workshops. They'll come to workshops, informational meetings about tsunamis because they find them fascinating. And so that gives us a little bit of an edge as opposed to just the regular emergency preparedness people. And so I think sometimes it's a good idea to talk, bring them in about tsunamis, but then we talk to them about emergency preparedness in general. So
I've just looked at my watch.
Okay.
I'm going to have to tell you that we're glad that you came, and let me get the other presenter up here before we lose our house members so that they have an opportunity to hear. Thank you so very much.
Thank you,
interesting, interesting presentation. I would like to talk to you for hours, probably.
Thank you, Senator.
All right, so
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Before we lose the train of your thought here, I would like to encourage us to also listen to perhaps some of the county preparedness in some of the other coastal counties, because the geography differs so much. And as I listen, I realize that there's, for example, in Lincoln County, a great deal of work that's somewhat the same and somewhat different. We also have a very active ham radio group who would love to tell you about it. So perhaps we could look at some of the programs that are in place up and down the coast as we're
permitting.
Talking about.
We'll certainly talk about that.
Thank you.
All right.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Senator Berger, and Representative Boone is the one that invited me. My name is Connie Saldana. I am a planner with Senior and Disability Services of Rogue Valley Council of Governments. I think originally on the agenda it mentioned that I also have been contracted to work with the state, but I am not speaking for seniors and people with disabilities at all. I'm here today to talk to you about seniors and people with disabilities and disaster preparedness. As we all know, all disasters are local. And when it comes to preparedness, we need to think on a local scale. You know, and we know that in Katrina, I think it's like 60% of all the victims of Katrina were either over 60 disabled or their caregivers. So we know this is a topic that's pretty important. And recently they did, the Department of Homeland Security reviewed all of the emergency preparedness plans and found out that most states, unless they're states that have disasters on a regular basis, were really lacking when it came to preparing for vulnerable populations. I have a little video that's about preparedness for people with disabilities, and since we're short on time, I've just given you a copy, and I encourage you to look at it, especially if you know a senior or a person with disabilities that should prepare. It helps them think about their own, what's special about their situation. So I'm going to skip right to my presentation. I'm from an area that was hit by a flood in 1997. And as a consequence, the emergency manager of our area came to us and came to seniors and senior disability services and said, when we got done with that disaster, we realized that you human service people look like a plate of spaghetti to us. So that began a partnership that has evolved over the years to quite a program of emergency preparedness for people with disabilities. And this PowerPoint that I put together talks about the most important key to preparedness, and this they found in Katrina. No matter what plans you have in place, it's the networks of people that you know that actually keep people safe. So this is about developing those networks. So here we see a variety of disasters that we can have in Oregon. You see the Ashland flood down there, volcanoes. So when we're talking about preparing in a community, this is what I would tell people. You need to build your coalition. Together, you need to assess your community. You need to make preparations and plans. And then you need to test them with an exercise, or, heaven forbid, you should actually have a disaster. Then there's a recovery phase, which you definitely need to think about. You need to evaluate all of the things that happen during the exercise, and then you may need to do your plan again. This is a process for all of emergency preparedness, but it definitely pertains to seniors and people with disabilities. And, of course, the most important key is community awareness, because no matter how we in government think we might be useful, we definitely can't save everybody. In fact, in Josephine County, we added up that there were probably about 6,000 people that lived around the county that would need some sort of assistance during the disaster. And a few years ago, there were only 70 combined police, sheriff, ambulance drivers, and whatnot. So obviously, we have to think of something else. And in a situation like this, human service providers become first responders. So, one of the things we discovered, there are four worlds that don't interact on a regular basis. Okay? We have emergency management and emergency responders, public health and hospitals, my realm, the human service providers, and then there are advocates. All of these people care about the well-being of seniors and people with disabilities, but they don't normally talk on a regular basis. One of the things we found out is that all of the assisted living and nursing homes were planning to evacuate in Phoenix, Oregon, to the same high school gym. And it turned out that the Red Cross had already designated that gym as a shelter. So, you see, you have to have a community-wide plan so that you see how your resources are used. This is probably the most important slide, so I'm going to take a little time on this. This is the Josephine County Special Needs Committee. About, I don't know, 4 years ago, we developed these committees in our two counties. You know, Rogue Valley is Jackson and Josephine County. This is what it looks like in Josephine County. Now, we don't generally have all of these people at the table at the same time, but they've all met together at some time to talk about the issue of emergency preparedness. So there's my agency right up there, Senior and Disability Services of RVCOG. Now, off here, not on this map, we have adult foster homes that we license right out of our office. And, of course, there are all kinds of other facilities out there and people living in their own homes. Here is Developmental Disability Services. They also have group homes, foster homes, and other kind of stakeholders off here in the end. Mental health. In our area, there's a crisis team. HRSA is basically a funding source, but it's Health Resource Services and Administration, and they're interested in hospitals and public health. Child care division, we have family daycare and child care centers. This group right here is a coalition, community organizations active in disaster, and their role in our community is mainly in recovery. These are all human service agencies that bring to the table a lot of resources. And agencies that we are, organizations we don't interact with on a regular basis too, like some of the churches, have a regular mission of providing certain services during a disaster. And then they're non-governmental service providers. Here's the Red Cross, parish nurses and churches. Here's emergency services, the fire, police. Here's our amateur radio, and again, they're very active in our process. They attend all of our meetings. Josephine County has an integrated fire plan, which has done clearing defensible space for people with low income. Here's the Josephine County emergency manager, who's been very involved in our process. Out of the meetings of this group, we determined that we needed a special plan for emergency transportation. So we created a transportation group, which includes the school districts, the ambulance provider, the independent living center, all of the assisted livings that have, and nursing homes that have their own vans that are, can use wheelchairs. They got together, they created an inventory of providers, they created a procedure of who would be the dispatcher, they created a form for keeping track of people when they've been evacuated, and they created a plan. Now, the plan has the potential of being annexed to the Josephine County Emergency Emergency Operations Plan, and it's in process. It's with County Council right now. In Josephine County, there is a long-term care facilities group, but I wanted to mention that the Jackson County long-term care facilities group actually got together and created a memorandum of agreement between them. So 24 facilities have agreed to support each other in a disaster. So that means one facility can receive the residents of another as long as they have, the care needs aren't too great. And we actually have, in both counties, used those facilities to receive people that needed to be evacuated that had care needs. For instance, during the Biscuit Fire, we were able to move people from Cave Junction into Grants Pass, and they just simply moved into facilities instead of opening up a special needs shelter or moving them to hospitals because they needed special care. Here's someone we hadn't thought about until we started this conversation, the durable medical equipment providers. Those guys know where everybody lives that has oxygen. That means they know about people that aren't our clients. Mm-hmm. You know, we can keep track of our clients, but there are a lot of people out there that don't qualify for our services. And that was the first time they'd all been in the room together. That was kind of interesting. Lifeline, Home Health. Here is our Citizen Corps, mm-hmm, with Neighborhood Watch, CERT, Medical Reserve Corps. They're all active. So in every community, this is going to look different. It depends on who's there, who serves the people, who cares about the people. But it gives you an idea that you have to get all of these folks at the table talking to each other, talking about the resources they bring to the table, talking about the needs of the people they serve, and then finding out what the expectations are of everybody else at the table.
Madam Chair,
Yes.
Just a quick question.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Is this shared with the Association of Oregon Counties? Are all of the counties aware of this?
I haven't spoken to the counties. I have spoken to a number of other organizations.
Well, the Association of Oregon Counties, to me, would be the ones. You belong to that association.
Yes, sure, we do.
And that would be a great place to share this. This is wonderful.
Well, maybe I'll just invite myself.
Well, yeah.
No, I'm sure that it's a very good idea. In fact, one of the things I'm going to talk to you today is about how we could help counties to do this kind of thing all around the state, because we want every county to, and I can report on what some counties are doing. I'm sorry, getting to the end of my time here, but I mentioned the first thing was assessment. So when you're assessing your community, you want to know who has special needs. There's not really one single formal definition of, well, now we're in Oregon, we're calling them vulnerable populations. Of course, we're focused on seniors and people with disabilities. It's broader, the homeless, the children, things like that. Each community has to decide. Then talk about what kind of disasters you might have in your area. Now, we don't have tsunamis over in Jackson and Josephine County, but we could have a snowstorm. Then there are other man-caused disasters, pandemic disease. The plan for each type of disaster will be a little bit different with vulnerable populations. Sometimes you want people to stay at home. Sometimes you'll need to move them. It depends on how serious disaster is and what it is. And also, we need to realize that for vulnerable populations, things that are not disasters for the rest of us can be disastrous for them. For instance, if you use a ventilator and the power goes out, you better have a backup generator, okay? If you use oxygen, you'll want to have oxygen in bottles if your concentrator doesn't work. If the power goes out and it's extremely hot or extremely cold, that's very serious for a fragile person. And we found with the Biscuit Fire that 40 miles away, people were having to stay inside because of the smoke. That's a different kind of disaster that the rest of us wouldn't normally think. I'm going to just skip through this. These are other considerations you'll want to do when you're doing your community assessment. You want to know what kind of accessible transportation you have, because you can't just pack everybody out in the back of your Geo. You know, some people have to have ambulance or at least wheelchair van. Does your community have accessible shelters, or what are the other options? I mentioned that in our community a couple of times we've used the long-term care facilities as our sheltering option. But it's worth talking about what would it take to have a special shelter for people that have care needs. In Florida, every county has several of those. And because there's so many vulnerable people in Florida and they have a disaster so often. Okay, other volunteer organizations. I mentioned the COAD, Community Organization Active in Disaster. So you all get together, you start asking what if questions. What if the freeway was down between Grants Pass and Medford? What would happen with the dialysis patients? They don't have, in Grants Pass, they don't have a generator to purify their water. They count on the city water. Well, that's a problem if you can't get people on dialysis to the other community. That's just an example. Okay, now then, in our area, we got a grant a few years ago, and we created a disaster registry. Disaster registries can take all kinds of forms, from the very most simple to ours is actually GIS-based. And we use volunteers to keep our disaster registry updated. And these are the questions we ask somebody if they are eligible for our disaster registry. Would you need outside help to safely leave your home if you were asked to evacuate? Would you be in jeopardy if you stayed in your own home without assistance for 3 days? Fire folks are telling us, make that 5. We might not get around to saving individuals for 5 days if we have to deal with the infrastructure and the disaster itself. Or would you need special notification about the need for evacuation? I just attended a training on the deaf and emergency preparedness. I've worked with people with disabilities now for close to 20 years, and I learned so many new things in that training. It was amazing. And I'll tell you, that's one population we definitely do not think about enough. Here's what our disaster registry looks like. This is the map. We've got Jackson County, Medford, Josephine County. There's Grants Pass. The little blue stars are people. And over here, if you click on one of those stars, this is kind of what you see. It has their address. Do they have mobility issues? This one says yes. This one has difficulty talking, hearing and vision impairment. And then it has their emergency contact information and things like this. We started out with a much huger bunch of information we were collecting, and then we realized that we just needed just a few things. What would a fireman need to know if you were knocking on that person's door and going to take them out of there? That person probably has a walker or a wheelchair that needs to go with them. You know, if he has hearing impairment, needs special communication. And then, of course, everybody needs to be calmed down. So how is the best way to communicate with that person? Now, in our disaster registry, we have a different layer. These are facilities. If they're way out in the area like this, those are probably adult foster homes, developmental disability foster homes. In town, we have all our nursing facilities and assisted living facilities. The firemen wanted to know where those are. That's very important. The Biscuit Fire was coming up here. Okay, if there are 20 people in an assisted living facility or 100 people, we want to get them out of there. Or the foster homes, of course, have up to 5 disabled people in them. Okay, so that's a disaster registry. Different areas around the state are doing different things with this. I can talk about that later if we have time. Okay, so you need to be thinking, your plan needs to include how is the Emergency Operations Center going to deal with vulnerable populations. So our special needs committees actually created a call takers form. And so when someone phones in, the call taker can triage them over to someone who knows how to deal with them, someone who knows about their special transportation needs or who can find a place for them to go. And so we're actually in that area creating a special needs branch that would operate if the Emergency Operations Center opens. Okay.
That's something we haven't heard, that you would have a separate a group that would just be dealing with the people that have disabilities.
Well, we've realized that most people don't know our resources, and so it's better to have the calls come to us. And then we would, the way the plan looks, and of course we haven't actually exercised this one yet, we're still developing it, we'd have somebody from Children's Services, somebody from developmental disability, our people, different people in the room who know all the different resources who could assist.
Mm.
And that'll take that burden off the Emergency Operations Center.
Mm-hmm.
We have already identified our special transportation for evacuation, and I've talked about special needs sheltering. Now, we were surprised to know when we got everybody to the table that Red Cross does not plan to keep people who have care needs, day-to-day care needs, in their shelter. They would be willing in our area to provide the facility, the beds, the food, but they do not have any way to do caregiving. So if we actually wanted to open a special needs shelter, we'd have to person it ourselves. We'd have to staff it ourselves. And so that's a community conversation right there. In our area, Red Cross for a small disaster puts people up in the motel, and I've talked about these other things. And, of course, very disabled people would automatically go to the hospital. Well, if we haven't done any planning ahead of time and we don't have any other option for them, that could fill the hospital up. And there we've already got people perhaps being injured by the disaster itself. And now we've got people who are already, for instance, bedridden or very fragile, needing to go to the hospital. That's going to be quite a crowd. Recovery, we need to think of people with disabilities have different needs, short, long, intermediate term. Raise community awareness, these are all people that care about seniors and people with disabilities. And we need to make them aware of the issues. Boy, I'm going to really have to talk fast. I'd already talked about individual preparedness. Oh, here's one. For vulnerable people, it's for some people, it's very unrealistic that they're going to get a 72-hour kit together and make an elaborate plan. But if they could do two things, they would cover themselves 85%, I think. One is to create an emergency health information card and put a copy of that on their refrigerator and a copy in their wallet. So somebody knows their condition and how to communicate with them. And the other is to get a buddy. And we say get a buddy and be a buddy because they, even a person with disabilities, can be checking in with someone. In fact, some of our disaster registry volunteers are homebound. They're actually on the registry, but they're contributing to the community by phoning every and keeping that registry updated. Okay, there's a summary. Okay, I wanted to quickly run through that because I just wanted to give you an idea of what different counties are doing around the state regarding seniors and people with disabilities. You want me to quit?
No.
No, okay. I mentioned in our area, let's see, and I have given you a copy of the Memorandum of Understanding between the long-term care facilities. And let's see here. In Lincoln County. Lincoln County, I've given you a little packet called Neighbor Helping Neighbor. That, a very amazing program, was created by a parent of a person with developmental disabilities. And she created this whole program because she realized that her daughter, if a tsunami were to come, would not, would need special assistance. So there's a wonderful citizen-created program, and you'll see in the back, someone came along and took that program to Thailand, where it was greatly welcomed, the whole concept of somebody looking after people with disabilities, and her signs and everything are even translated into Thai. Lincoln County has some volunteers that are creating a very elaborate GIS project, working with the fire departments, creating little islands around them, and even where helicopters can land, etc. But the good thing about theirs is they have the capability of putting a disaster registry of vulnerable people on that. And their developmental disability department over there is working with them, so that's where they're active with special needs people. And Crook, Deschutes, Jefferson counties, they have a planning committee that's starting to operate, and their AAA over there has created a really simple inventory of vulnerable people, and their plan is, I have 5 staff people. If the emergency happens, you call these pages, you call these pages, you call these pages, and that's how they would make sure people are safe. Marion County has a really good vulnerable populations annex. Clatsop County, again, parents have created a really wonderful program over there of how to educate people with developmental disabilities to keep themselves safe and how to work together, and they have a buddy program there too.
Mrs. Saldana, there's a couple of things I wanted to mention to you. One is that sometimes people are disabled or have disabilities at the time of a crisis who are not necessarily disabled people. In other words, mm-hmm. they've just gotten home after surgery on a knee replacement, and then a disaster happens. Mm-hmm. So basically, people have to be thinking somewhat. They may be disabled
right
at the time of a disaster.
They should definitely get a buddy. And, I mean, in the Rogue Valley, they could be on our disaster registry for a temporary time if they wanted to. But you're absolutely right. Everybody needs to be thinking about this. Yep.
The other thing that I wanted to mention to you is that I believe that when people are limited in their ability to move around on their own, to get up and run out of the house or climb the hill or whatever, there is a real stress factor and a fear factor that's there because they are dependent that isn't there in the rest of us that are able-bodied.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some people are very afraid. And then on the other hand, people that have lived with disability all their lives, some of them are very, very unflappable. You know, they've been through it all already. But it just, again, points to the fact that people need to think about their own situation. If they're going to have a communication problem because of fear, they can't talk or whatever, they need to draw up a plan and make sure that somebody knows about it so that they know how to talk to them if they come to help them in an emergency. So a lot of it is people thinking ahead or a caregiver thinking for the individual what their special needs are.
I guess I ask you about the counties preparing, but this is a COG effort.
This is the what?
COG. A Council of Government right. effort.
Right. But so, COGs, the counties, both counties belong to our COG.
Well, okay. So there's, you know, LCOG and there's a Western mm-hmm. COG, in fact.
Cascades.
Yeah, Cascade mm-hmm. And so on and so forth. So is this something that COGs are doing aside from your COG?
Yes, in the sense that the ones that have area agencies on aging have been alerted to this.
Okay.
We've been
in
working
fact,
with Lane
had
COG.
People in the audience yeah. who are no longer here.
Right.
And I was,
mm-hmm.
okay.
Yeah, for sure. And we've definitely been getting the word out for as many years as we've been doing this project about it to let people know what the possibilities are. And like I say, what we have in Southern Oregon works for us, but it would be different in different areas.
Yeah.
They need to design what works for them. But what everybody needs to do is get to the table. So what I was going to recommend is everybody has a mandate. The area agencies on aging have a mandate. Emergency management has a mandate. Public health has a mandate to think about vulnerable populations. But every one of those groups say, we don't have the resources to do
it. It's an unfunded mandate.
An unfunded mandate. But I would propose that it would take very, very few resources to staff these ongoing committees. We were lucky in our area. We got a grant to pay my time to just simply keep those meetings running, convene them, do the minutes, get everybody there. And I think that for as little as $5,000 a year, you could staff that whole community process. You could come up with a plan and everything else. So I know that... Budgets are always tight, but I just wanted to put it out there that, you know, Buckminster Fuller talks about a trim tab, which is the little thing you can do to turn the whole rudder, to turn the whole ship. And this tiny little amount of money for community planning would make a huge difference in the safety of vulnerable populations. So if there were any way that could happen somewhere down the road, I would definitely recommend it. And I guess I'll just... with that, I do want to say that Multnomah County is implementing a disaster registry, web-based disaster registry, using Network of Care, which is a statewide website, and it's a wonderful resource. So I'm just going to leave it at that. And
well, you've had a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
I'm sorry that you've had to hurry. I'm so used to 2 hours, and we really need 2 hours in this committee. This thing of cutting it off at an hour, it's very, very difficult because we have lots of questions, and we want to be able to get into the in-depth part of it. I think your presentation, well, both of them today have just been excellent.
Yeah. Very good.
And I think it would be really worthwhile if I could clone both of you so that you could go into one working with volunteers and one working on planning for people with special needs. And you've given us a jewel of an idea in talking about a separate group of people to answer the phone.
Oh,
in
right.
case of a disaster, because that is huge for the people that are trying to answer the phone about crises that are happening.
Right.
And then here are these people with very special needs, and if you have people manning those phones that understand that whole situation,
right.
I can see where that would be very, very advantageous.
Well, it would be the outgrowth of them all meeting. You couldn't just kind of mandate it and say, do it, because if they don't know each other, it's not going to be as useful as if the whole community is
working together. And how many weeks did you meet with this big group that you had?
Well, the special needs committees are ongoing. They've been meeting for several years on a monthly basis,
okay.
and they've been taking on different projects as they go. But I think that a community planning process, you know, in a rural community you could probably do it in a year, you know, just meeting once a month. They need to be meeting on an ongoing basis, even if it's only quarterly, because their resources change
That's
and
right.
their needs change
That's
and things
right.
like that. They'd have to be checking back in. But
but to get people the community awareness and to actually put the plan into effect,
and all, which would be what you're doing, and then you both are doing great work in different ways.
Right.
And I think communities need it both. Well, thank you so very much.
And, you're very welcome.
We were very happy to have you here today. And again, my apologies for having to rush both of you through your presentations. And with that, I'll call the meeting.
Thank you for the opportunity.